Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Well, hey, Phil. How's it going, man?
Oh, super fantastic. How are you, buddy?
Oh, real good. Just going to have to put the iPad aside for a second so we can do this show.
Put your iPad aside, yes. Don't be fiddling with your iPad. So you're allowing us all to believe that you were one of the initial 700,000 that were shipped out. Is that
it's a joke. I have not yet purchased my iPad. I'm going to I think I'll wait until generation 2 or 3. Before actually putting out the dough for that. I've noticed that, for example, the iPhone now runs about $100. When it was first offered, it was about $500 about three or four generations ago, and not nearly as cool as it is now. So, my theory is if the entry level iPad is $500 now, in a couple of years it'll be $100 and 10 times as neat. So maybe I'll just hang on and wait for it to catch up.
Well, you know, that's what we say about your hosts here on Fast Forward Radio, is not only are we the folksy transhumanists, we're the perversely late adopter transhumanists, really, when it comes to certain technology.
We believe things are getting better all the time, but we're cheap.
Cheap. Better all the time includes cheaper. And if it's getting better all the time, it's like, well, if I wait a year, let them work the kinks out. But something you said, I think, is important to note about the iPad. And that is that the iPhone got cooler, but it was always cool in the sense that it was always a hip, desired, coveted item. And that you cannot say 100% about the iPad the way you could about the iPhone.
That's true. That's true because in some ways you almost have to have a sense of irony to show up someplace holding it. You know, I mean, it's almost uncool. It's such a happening thing that you kind of it's almost uncool to have one. It would seem, and it certainly one thing about it is you can't fit it in a pocket. You're basically going to need a case for it, just like you would a laptop. So you know, but it doesn't have a keyboard. There's some question in my mind as to where exactly it fits in the scheme of things. But I'm sure applications will be made for it. So,
that is the discussion people are having is where does this fit in? It's it's smaller than a laptop, but it's bigger than a phone. And it's not your phone, and it's not your laptop. And I was reading today, it doesn't have a USB port, so you can't hook it to your printer. And so there's all of that kind of just sort of working out a niche for it. But then the other thing you and I were talking about before the show started. There is some contention about the iPad, whether it is in fact a good thing to have or not. It's not universally beloved. I was just saying that James Lilek's got one, and he seems to be quite pleased with it. But at the same time, we know that Cory Doctorow has been bashing on it pretty bad. So
yeah.
we're not, as followers when it comes to this kind of stuff, we're not quite sure who to believe or where to turn with this thing.
Right.
Since Cory's been on the show, we got to go with him, huh?
Well, but I like Lilacs as well. I mean, that guy can write, and he has a happening podcast, or at least he did. I haven't heard it in a while. But anyway, And so I'm going to have to give him props too. And so basically I'm completely on the fence about the iPad, and we'll just wait and see.
Yeah, well, not to, you know, no disrespect to Lilacs. I mean, he once left a comment on the Speculus back when we were nothing. So, you know, he's tops in my book as well. Plus, every Tuesday I have to read the Funny Comics cover over on the Bleat. So that's something I look forward to every week. Well, anyhow, we got a bunch of stuff. We've got probably about, I'm going to say, 2 months' worth of shows, worth of topics to get into tonight. So we're gonna jump right into that after we've talked about a few other things. I wanted to talk a little bit briefly about the NCAA Men's Basketball Championship game, which aired last night. Did you happen to catch any of that by any chance?
You're all on your own on this topic, Phil. I'm sorry, I missed it.
Okay, well, the Final Four came down to the final two teams, and it was Duke versus an obscure little school from Indianapolis called Butler. And there was much to-do made in the press about Butler, this little school from Indiana, 4,100 students, and here they are progressing through the March Madness, making their way to the Final Four, making their way to the championship game, and in fact, they were still in it with 0 seconds left on the clock, because that kid from Butler at half court threw a shot that, you know, it was a fraction of an inch off, and they could have won. Okay, so, I mean, as close a game as you would ever ever want to see. It just, they, you know, it's like Hoosiers, the sequel. Okay, this little school from Indiana comes and takes on the champion, the top school in the country, Duke, and almost takes it all. So that's been the narrative. Okay, that's been the big story, Cinderella story, Butler versus Duke, and I like that. I like that whole Cinderella thing. But I want to go back a couple of brackets. Okay. Because before Butler beat Kansas State and before they beat Syracuse, Butler played a school named Murray State University. Murray State University is it's in rural Kentucky, the western end of Kentucky, and it is, in fact, where I went to college, okay? And like Butler, it's a school of about 4,000 students. And the previous, like, 48 hours to Butler and Murray playing each other, Murray had actually played Vanderbilt and beaten them, okay, to advance to the second round. So now you've got these two schools of roughly the same size playing each other in the second round of the NCAA tournament. It's just so exciting that Murray has made it. And it's not the first time. They've actually, they were there once before in the 80s, at least, and showed Kansas State quite a rough time for it. But here's what's really interesting. Final score of the Murray-Butler game, 54-52, okay? And it was also a two-point game last night between Duke and Butler. One-shot game. So one-shot game, and Murray actually, the dude was making a shot at the end, didn't make it, so they lost. Likewise, Butler right at the end making a shot, and so they lost. I guess my contention here, okay, and I think you've got to work with me, right, is that Murray could have won the whole thing.
Okay, all right.
See, because they almost beat Butler, and Butler almost – see where I'm going?
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking it would have been cool to see those two small schools in the final game.
Well, the brackets weren't situated such that could occur, but that would have been awesome. Yeah. That would have been that would have been really exciting if
Rocky
one of these like
beats Rocky, you know, would
yeah, one of these little schools like Siena or Arkansas Poplar Bluff, right, had made it against it would have been the real Rocky story, but. But when you come down to just, you know, a shot on the rim that doesn't go in one game, and a shot on the rim that doesn't go in two games later, you're really down to just these very, very small, chancy things, right? So it seems like things could have worked out differently. And in fact, if one believes in the many worlds hypothesis, right now there are universes in which Murray State has won the whole thing. And speaking of the many worlds hypothesis, Stephen, I think you have some interesting news on that subject.
Well, yeah. Fox News put out a put out an article here, and I'd actually seen it at another news source as well, but it's, the headline I thought was pretty funny. Freaky physics proves parallel universes exist. And it really comes down to they actually showed for the first time with a visible object quantum effects. They had a little piece of metal about the width of a human hair that was both vibrating and not vibrating at the same time. And apparently, according to the math or according to whatever their theories are at this point, then this demonstrates parallel universes. I'm not sure how that works. Also, I mean, they're also talking about the possibility of time travel because this is so, and all kinds of strange and interesting things. But I thought it was pretty interesting, and I'm going to put the link in the chat room and in the show notes.
Well, I think we'd all really like to know how a thing can be vibrating and not vibrating at the same time. This is not how that can be, because I'll take it as a given that such a thing can exist, since light can be a particle and a wave, right? A piece of matter can be vibrating and not vibrating at the same time. That indicates that in one locus, one universe, it's vibrating, and in the other one, it's not, right? I guess. So the interesting thing is, if this is really proof that there are parallel universes, then you've got the possibility, however remote, of if we can observe what's happening in a parallel universe, which apparently we can here in this instance with this one particle, then that opens up the possibility of observing all kinds of other cool things. For example, witnessing the universe where Murray won the whole championship, or witnessing a universe that's out of sync with ours chronologically, so that you could essentially, if not travel into the past, view the past, and if not travel into the future, view the future. So time travel, at least from the standpoint of observation.
Yeah, and it creates some interesting ideas. I'm sure some sci-fi guys are going to run with this and have some fun with have some fun with the concepts, as if they haven't already, right?
But, no doubt, yeah. That's one of my favorite themes, actually. I love Greg Egan's take on that in a couple of the novels that
Zemeckis can start arguing that Back to the Future is hard sci-fi now.
It's hard science, that's right, for sure. You know, as soon as he tells us exactly what it is that the flux capacitor does, all right, then we'll I mean he doesn't have to show us one, just tell us what it's doing, and we'll start to buy into that. Okay, well we've got those little tidbits out of our system. Let's get into our three major topics here for this evening. And the show has an unusual name this evening. I called it Plastic Brains, Roboticized Jobs, and Nano Doctors. And basically, this is just I picked three recent posts that we'd put up over at The Speculist. I thought it was interesting how these ideas sort of go together. Don't exactly go together, but sort of go together. And how they all add up to a view of the world, a set of scenarios for the future, pretty radically different from the world we live in now. Let's start with, I guess, probably the most mundane one, which is I'm going to say the roboticized jobs.
Right, right.
Would
this
you agree
that? we talked about this several times recently. Once, I believe it was with Cory Doctorow, we spent some time talking with him about it, and the idea, of course, is that that's not the author we talked to recently about that, is it, Phil?
It is. We did a whole series on the new economy. Corey was one of them. Martin Ford was the other, actually.
Okay.
We
actually spent a little more time with Martin Ford on the subject, but because his whole book was about it. But our thought basically is that, you know, although we hate the idea of humans being removed from the workforce, I can't think of any really good reason that it won't happen. If machines are more efficient at doing certain jobs, then I think that those jobs will end up being done by machines. And to a large extent, we've already seen it happen with some jobs. And I think it'll become more and more that way as robots become more capable and as expert systems become well, more expert or more generally
more nearly, yeah, the actual experts themselves, yeah.
Right.
Well, I'll tell you something I read. I had mentioned to you that this blog post I did on this, the title of the post was What If the Jobs Never Come Back, got picked up over on Facebook by our buddy Wayne Rudinsky from the Boulder Future Salon, and a very interesting discussion around this whole topic emerged there. And I was just reading one of the comments this afternoon as I was putting together some ideas for what we want to talk about today. It was really interesting. This guy had done a video, and I'll get the YouTube video and put it up on the Speculist, of just showing how an automated cashier system works at McDonald's. And I had not heard this, but apparently there's a lot of talk about this amongst geek circles, and I had not heard this before. McDonald's had set out a goal probably 7 or 8 years ago that eventually they are going to have fully automated restaurants. Had you ever heard that?
You know, I had not, but I have seen something that was I thought was really neat at a local McDonald's in my own town.
Well, what do they got?
Well, they got a drink automated system. Basically, whatever kind of drink, you tell the person. Let's say I'm going through the drive-thru window and I want a large Diet Coke. Well, they punch on the register large Diet Coke, and a robotic system goes to work, grabs the right cup, and pours the right Coke, and it comes down this little kind of, not a long conveyor belt or anything. It's like maybe 3 feet long. And the person at the window grabs it off that and hands it to you. You know, puts a lid on it and hands it to you.
What's interesting about that is you say it's not a long conveyor belt. When you think about it, not really a very complicated process making a drink at McDonald's. I mean, it's
No, it's not. But it's I thought that was pretty interesting. And you can do that. How much more complicated would it be to do burgers and fries? You know,
exactly. So interesting to see that they actually are working on the back end of the restaurant. The video that I saw is all about the ordering part. So it's a kiosk-based McDonald's where you go up and you pick your burger, you pick your fries, you pick your drink, or you pick your, Happy Meal or whatever it is. And then you pay, and then when the time comes, it's like a little chute or whatever, and the food comes out. You're not dealing with – now, there are people in the back doing all the jobs, but one of the things that either this fellow or someone who was commenting on the video wrote was – they're going to implement this nationwide, and probably in the next 5 years, and I would say 10, just to be safe, not to be skeptical about how fast something like this could be implemented. But he says, in the next 5 years, the entire job of fast food cashier will disappear. And
yeah.
I think that is not at all an unlikely scenario. And he says, this will be devastating. I mean, this a lot of people work in that field. Those jobs won't exist anymore. Those people are all going to be out of work. And I thought of what my stock answer to that would have been 6 months ago or a year ago or 2 years ago. And that would have been, right, okay, when the first self-serve gas pump got installed someplace, we could have said the same thing about, I'm going to say hundreds of thousands, millions of people who pump gas for a living, right? The service station attendant job as we knew it was doomed, and that all those people were going to be put out of work, and it would be a horrible, just a catastrophe for everyone in that line of work. But history does not record that, right? I mean, yes, people stopped doing that job, but as far as it being a big devastating thing, not so much, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there were other jobs to do, but I mean, when automation becomes gets to the point that more and more of these jobs are taken, then whole fields are shut down. What are these folks going to do? Now let me tell you about my job.
Before you do, I just want to finish the thought there. I was actually going someplace
go
with it, which was that's what I would have said a couple of years ago. Nothing to worry about. The gas station attendants all found other jobs. They probably all ended up being cashiers at McDonald's, or a lot of them did, right? But But there was job. There were jobs for them. That was before, I think, we had our awareness kind of raised by Corey and Martin and some of these others talking about this thing. And I think before I really took a hard look at this whole notion of a jobless recovery and an economy where even the most serious students of the economy look at it and say, yes, we can have major economic growth without adding jobs and, in fact, while decreasing the number of jobs. And you say, well, if that's the case, then it's not a given that jobs are going to come in and introduce themselves for the people who used to be the cashiers at McDonald's. Unlike the economy we were in even a couple of decades ago, I guess maybe two and a half, three decades ago, when there was this switch over from people pumping gas to people pumping their own gas, and the economy just absorbed that difference, things might actually be different now. And that's a daunting thought. I'm sorry, where were you going with that, Stephen?
Well, I've got a, you know, just today, I was reading an article, and I wish I had the link for it. I'll try to find it for the show notes. Basically saying that, you know, experts are talking about 2015, some vehicles being equipped with automatic driving so that when you're on the interstate or other, you know, closed access places like that, that it'll automatically drive for you. And that, you know, that's coming as soon as 2015. And by 2020, there'll be systems that'll be complex enough to drive for you all the time. And my thought is, well, you know, that's pretty much the end of my job. I'm a personal injury attorney. Primarily, that's the kind of cases I handle is when people are involved in automobile accidents. Well, if you know, these systems are so good that there aren't any automobile accidents, then there goes that industry, right? And then eventually, there goes, you know, insurance along with it. Now, I mean, nobody's going to shed too many tears about that. I mean, that's including myself. That's a better world we're talking about where people are not hurt in automobile accidents. But, I mean, that's, you know, if, you know, automation is going to hit, I guess my point is that automation is going to hit every field eventually. And,
right.
And you know, then the world will be a much different place. It'll be a more efficient place. It'll be a place that there'll be more wealth. Automation will create it, but there might be fewer people with jobs to basically have the money to buy the things that new world creates. At least that's what Martin Ford seemed to think. So,
right. Well, I think the as Sally points out in the chat room, that one part of the jobless recovery is a huge increase in productivity. That's exactly what we're talking about. We're much more productive with fewer resources required, including human resources, in order to achieve that level of productivity. So the economy can grow stupendously. It can grow massively, and that's the other side of this that we're not necessarily talking about right now, which is that I think we're only looking at the tip of the iceberg both ways, right? We're only looking at the tip of the iceberg in terms of jobs lost, and we're only looking at the tip of the iceberg in terms of how much productivity can be achieved and how much wealth can be created. The trick is we used to have a very straightforward map for how all that productivity got turned into the livelihood of most of the people, and
right.
Now that's muddled. Now it's unclear exactly how that happens, and most of the models that get presented for how to make that happen are less than satisfying for one reason or another. We won't go into all of them. I talked about them in the blog post, and we've talked about them with Martin, and we've talked about them with Corey. But it seems that either employment will go away, or it will change, or our expectations of what it means will change, or how we add value, something is going to have to change fairly substantially, and it could be several things that have to change fairly substantially in order to make that leap, in order for us to once again be in a world where, yes, all that productivity is going on, and yes, everyone, not everyone, but by and large, people are enjoying the benefits of that productivity. That's the trick. If currently the way you enjoy the benefits of the productivity is you go get yourself a job. You work your way up a ladder. You've got a salary, and you're enjoying the benefits of the productivity through your contribution to it. If there's
and
no
you go
means
buy your to, iPad with the money that you
go out and get yourself an iPad. If there's no way for you to make the contribution, if your contribution is just simply not needed at any level,
yeah, the iPad production process requires no human at all.
Yeah,
and
then it's trickier. Now we've got Will saying that the trick is preparing yourself to take advantage of alternate options before they become commonplace. And in fact, I would say that that is the scenario that Corey laid out in Makers, that
right.
the Makers Revolution was one of people saying, oh wait, I can do something with value. Its shelf life is short, but people will buy this for a limited time, and I can create something for a limited time, and that eventually, in that story anyway, became something of a bubble because the changing sands of the economy were just moving so rapidly that people weren't able to keep up.
I like the way Sally put it in the chat. What we're talking about tonight is the troublesome transition period. Yeah, I mean, this might be, you can think of it perhaps as the awkward teen phase, you know,
exactly.
Where we're not kids anymore doing the, you know, we're using the old model, and we're not quite to, we're certainly not to the post-singularity model we are as smart as we need to be to do whatever job needs to be done. We're kind of in the middle, and so, or maybe we're beginning to be in the middle.
Absolutely. I think that that's really the issue, that either that transition has started, and it looks to me increasingly like there are reasons to at least suggest that it has, or we're going to be in it soon. And one of my concerns about this actually is that when it really hits, it's going to hit hard. You know, I mean, you think about how we feel the impact of new technological developments, how it seems that, overnight everyone has a smartphone. It didn't really happen that way, but it's like overnight your great aunt has a Facebook page, right? I mean, suddenly
it was the adoption period for these things was fast, man. I mean, think of how long it took, the adoption period of, say, personal computers. It was a long time. I mean, from the time that personal computers were first introduced in the late 70s, how long was it until basically everyone had one in developed countries? It took a long time. But
right.
What about cell phones? You know, I mean, there are third world countries where everybody's walking around with a cell phone.
Right, much faster.
Things are speeding up.
Absolutely, and the downside of that is when something potentially harmful is carried along the same wave, it can also happen very fast and in a really really devastating way. And the reason I'm kind of concerned about that, and what I was trying to get across in my post was, not only does the potential for that to be a shocking and painful transition, not only is that potential there, that potential is not something that our political class is really concerned with at all.
Right.
They've got other ideological fish to fry, and I'm not saying that those aren't important issues or that that doesn't all need to get worked out. Obviously, it does, and I have my own views on where things need to go, and other people have their views on where things need to go. But there becomes a point at which they're missing the bigger picture here. We're not there yet. At this point, they're missing the smaller picture.
Yeah, I don't think the Republican or Democratic leadership have any clue about the issues we're talking about.
And the thing is, it can become the big picture really fast. And
yeah.
if they're still in a mindset that everything is as it was in the 19th century or even the middle part of the 20th century, they're not going to be able to address it because they just can't see it. You know, it's just
right.
not part of their. The word I kept using was template. You know, it's just it's not part of the narrative. They're following. It's not part of the story that they've told themselves that is the story of how the world works. And I think that that's going to create the potential for some really interesting times in the near future. I hope that the transition finds a way not to be that painful at all, and in fact that some of the things that other people have talked about, this increased entrepreneurial spirit, this ability that people have to make their own stuff, you and I are very big on this idea of the means of production passing into the hands of the workers, that we're all much more capable than we used to be. So perhaps that increased capability provides a way for us to work our way around this employment problem. There also should just be a way that if we do become massively more productive, there ought to be a way that can translate into real jobs for people. You know, there should be some formula where that would work out, even if I can't think of what that is right off the top of my head. So there's a number of possible ways it can pan out. It's just that not all of them are all that happy, at least for a certain period of time.
You know, I'm thinking about the healthcare debate. You know, that was obviously, you know, heavily fought on both sides of that issue. And it seems to me that's just another example of a huge issue that was fought with old ideas on both sides. I don't
Absolutely.
Think either side was considering a possible future where 90% of our health care, I mean, and I'm talking, you know, in the next 10 or 15 years, 90% of our health care could be given by expert systems and potentially robots. I mean, that's a pretty big change from what we're looking at. So,
I'm thinking of
the typical clinic becoming, you know, manned by maybe one or two nurse practitioners and a computer system that serves as a doctor for 90% of your problems.
Right,
and if you have a broken leg, then you go someplace else to get it put in a cast or something. You see a specialist, but for 90% of what you need, you go to a clinic that's mostly run by a computer. So.
Yeah, to me, the healthcare debate is the whole problem in miniature. Okay, it actually is this entire fixation with comfortable issues that are part of both parties' template and part of both of their, you know, opposite or distinctly different ways of looking at the world. Because it looks to me like if the actual problem is that there's not enough healthcare to go around, not everybody who needs it gets it, and, you know, we could argue that point or not, but let's just take that as a given for a moment, okay, that there's not enough. I don't see how the big solution, one way or the other, is changing the distribution methodology. To me, I go, well, okay, well, then we ought to have more, right? You know, why don't we produce more healthcare, and then we wouldn't have that big of a problem. And the way you produce more stuff in the age we live in today is you digitize things, you automate things, you make them broadly available via the technologies that we have. That is the obvious direction for healthcare to be going, and it seems to me that both sides of that debate would see a lot of benefit in going that way, but neither side is ready to look at it from that standpoint because they've got so much invested politically and kind of ideologically and economically in this existing model of how things work. But speaking of that, I'm glad you brought up the healthcare debate because that transitions us very nicely from the first part of the scenario, which is that you lose your job to a robot, you get really depressed, and then illness sets in. But that's okay here in the near future. Stephen, tell us about what's going to be on tap to treat you for that illness.
Well, I mean, nanobots, for one thing. A neat article I saw a couple of days, well, about a week or so ago now, talking about how they're using what amounts to a nanobot, but it's really just a molecule that attaches itself or is basically given a payload of medicine. And you just inject it into the patient, and because of the molecule's chemical makeup, it seeks out, or, you know, as it circulates through the body, through the circulatory system, it attaches itself to the places that it's needed. And then it dumps its medical payload, and then it's eliminated from the system. By doing that, I mean, in the particular test that they were using, they were treating cancer patients with chemotherapy in exactly that way, where you needed very little just a fraction of the amount of the drugs, because you don't have to blast the whole system. It just you just send it where it needs to go, and so just a fraction of the amount of medicine, very few side effects, because it only hits where it's needed. And then it hits hard where it's needed, because it's the medicine accumulates in that one place. And they were talking about that is a model that they could use not only for cancer in delivering chemotherapy drugs, but also viral infections, and bacterial infections. Even some traumatic injuries could be treated in this way. And that could absolutely revolutionize medicine.
Well, I think it's going to. It's funny that the vision, the earliest vision of this that I ever saw that anyone had was a really cheesy movie from the late 60s called The Fantastic Voyage. You're familiar with that movie, I'm sure.
Absolutely, yeah.
Where the where wonderful the doctors get
movie.
Yeah, well, absolutely. It's got Raquel Welch, a very young, vital Raquel Welch. So it's got that going for it. But group of surgeons are shrunk down to size, and their little craft is shrunk down to size, and they are injected into the human body to go repair. I don't know, the guy's got cancer. I don't remember the plot of the story. But essentially, they had everything right except for the nonsense about taking human beings and shrinking them down. The methodology is absolutely sound. It's the right way to go because, really, when you think about it, this is what you're attempting to do anytime you take any kind of medicine internally. When you take a pill, when you're given an injection, something is being introduced into your system, introduced into your bloodstream that the hope is will react with either your immune system to bolster it or with what's out of balance in your body or something that is foreign in your body that shouldn't be there and either restore that balance or get rid of, you know, eliminate that thing that's not supposed to be there. That medicine is supposed to come in, do only that, and then get out of your body and not do anything else. That's the perfect model for medicine. And it's really hard to do that with chemicals. Right, because for one thing, chemicals do whatever they want to do. I mean, they react with the stuff they're supposed to react with, and they react with things that we didn't expect them to react with. It's why you have these.
And at the same time, that we see this revolution taking place, we also are making better medicine too.
Oh yeah,
because of our understanding of DNA and the unraveling of the human genome, and we say, okay, now we can tailor make drugs to exactly this problem, and cut the side effects, completely by making this particular molecule, and then we can build those molecules from scratch, and then not even blast the whole body with that medicine, have them delivered exactly where you want. I mean, this is new frontiers here, and
absolutely
quite a bit different.
Yeah, and I think the point is well made about genetic based medicine, DNA based medicine, which ultimately I think that teams up with nanotechnology or becomes a distinct branch of nanomedicine, because really DNA is kind of the original nanotechnology. I mean, it's really sort of the original
proof of concept.
It is. It's a proof of concept for computers and for molecular machinery and an awful lot of stuff that we talk about here. Now, what's interesting about this is, I don't know if you saw the Kurzweil AI newsletter today.
I missed it today. What was
headline? Carbon nanotubes broken down by white blood cells. So this was interesting.
I did see it.
Okay, there we go.
I did see it. So cool. I mean, now the concern has always been that once we live in a world where carbon nanotubes are everywhere, where my shirt is made out of carbon nanotubes, because carbon nanotubes are so cool, you can do all these things. I can have embedded computers in my now bulletproof shirt that's as thin and subtle as cotton,
Right.
All these cool things I can do with nanotubes, but it's gonna, it'll ruin our health because these things will accumulate in our bodies and can't be broken down, and it'll be like mercury. Over time, you'll just you'll get sicker and sicker and then die. Well,
absolutely.
I don't like that's pretty dystopian. I don't like that. That's gratifying to know that the body can handle carbon nanotubes, at least according to this article.
Yeah, it's a big breakthrough. Up to this point, it has been speculated and pretty much assumed that carbon nanotubes would be, the term they use here is biopersistent, and therefore potentially toxic, for exactly the reason you said. You got this little tiny stuff accumulating in your body, and it would become just another mass of junk that you don't want in your system, causing all kinds of havoc. Apparently not the case. An enzyme, I'm not going to try to read it, but the abbreviation is MPO, in white blood cells, breaks carbon nanotubes right down. And,
you know, we shouldn't be surprised that our body can handle carbon.
That's true, yeah. Depending on how you take carbon in, you don't want to be breathing too much coal dust. But there are good and bad ways to take carbon into the body. But here's the quote from Bengt Fadel, associate professor at the Swedish Medical University Karolinska Institute. And I'm sorry, Bengt, if I mispronounced your name. Probably Dr. Fadel, actually. But he says this means that there might be a way to render carbon nanotubes harmless, for example, in the event of an accident at a production plant. So even if there was a wide dispersal of these into the atmosphere, this chemical that we make in our bodies, it turns out, might be a good way to neutralize those. And he ends it with this, and this is where it swings it back to what we've been talking about. But the findings are also relevant to the future use of carbon nanotubes for medical purposes. So one of the most useful proto-technologies, you know, part of the machine tools kit that we talk about for nanotechnology, has got to be the carbon nanotube. And now we're saying, oh, yeah, nano robots, tiny nanoscale robots that are put into your body that that are there to correct disease, that are there to fix injury, you know, whatever it is that they're there to do. Yes, carbon nanotubes can definitely be part of what they use in implementing their strategies to make your body healthier, because your body can deal with those. So it's terrific news in terms of carbon nanotubes aren't dangerous, but it's also great news in terms of, here's another good technology that will be available for us once we make that leap into real nanobot-driven medicine.
Sally asked in the chat room, have you read some of Kurzweil's ideas of improving the human body before uploading? Sally, one of the things I seem to remember was him suggesting that carbon nanotubes could make our bones much, much stronger. If we can use carbon nanotubes within our bodies without causing ourselves harm, then that's good news.
Absolutely. And in fact, I've heard Kurzweil talk also about we've talked about this a number of times, respirocytes, the replacement red blood cells that would be able to hold oxygen much more efficiently, allowing people to stay underwater for hours at a time, and allowing guys like you and I to run the 4-minute mile and accomplish other astounding things. So there are amazing things that can be done with the human body, shy of actually just replacing it with a robot or subsuming us up into the virtual world, and I think we'll probably see a lot of those be implemented once we make that leap from macro scale medicine being the norm to nanoscale medicine being the norm. And someone, I want to give him credit for asking the question, because I thought it was a good question, and now I cannot. I apologize.
That was Robert Freitas that proposed respirocytes originally, I think.
Oh, okay. Well, Kurzweil talks about it. But that does sound right. Anyway, sorry, whoever it was in the chat room, but someone asked, will the medical establishment, for example, the FDA, allow this transition to occur? What do you make of that question?
Well, I think that's absolutely the thought behind that question is absolutely right. I think the FDA and doctor lobbyist groups like the AMA and things like that will fight this tooth and nail. So it may not be adopted first here. You might see it in countries where maybe there's not enough doctors, or the doctor lobby is very very weak. Countries like, you know, third world countries could end up with better medicine than we have, because the powers that be fight it so hard here in this country. You could see, I definitely could imagine that happening.
I agree. Ken asked that question. Thanks, Sally. And thanks for the question, Ken. I think it's an excellent question. I agree that the powers that be will fight for their vested interests, whether that be the AMA, as Ken asked about, or the FDA, or any number of other potential kind of threatened vested interests there. However, to me, this one goes back to the question that we had about the legality of genetically enhancing infants or embryos in vitro. And our final answer on that was that, you know, try and stop people, right? That will actually find its way through. I think what would happen is if you've got highly effective treatments for heart disease, for cancer, for diabetes that are available elsewhere in the world, the powers that be in this country can lose their powers fairly rapidly because I think it's possible that that we would just see a, you know, pretty much a people would either vote with their feet and go someplace where they get the treatment themselves, or eventually they would vote at the ballot box and say, no, we will have this, and they would put a leadership structure in place that would enable that. Elsewhere, another commenter mentioned, and I'm sorry, I'm just not able to scroll backwards through the comments tonight to get the names, that Methuselah Foundation, I just got this email day before yesterday and have been meaning to get up on the blog, offering a new $1 million prize for the first group that produces a complete human organ. So it's a special prize just for artificially producing human organs. And that's the same kind of radical capability that, yes, would be very threatening to the existing, some parts of the existing medical infrastructure. But, you know, you tell people with damaged or diseased hearts that they can get a new heart, a brand new heart that's a perfect genetic match for their own, they're going to find a way to do that. That's my answer to that.
Well, and my thought is, you know, what if, you know, we have an analogy that can be made, a historical analogy that can be made. What happened during the Prohibition when the law was one way and the will of the people was completely, you know, in an opposite direction? Well, you had widespread lawlessness. You had people that were, you know, disobeying the law. I mean, it was the sort of thing that actually created organized crime.
And, absolutely. And
it's not good. It is not good when a majority of the population or a substantial portion of the population chooses to ignore the law. And so, what do you do? Well, the law needs to change. And if you've got powers that be, are basically saying, no, we're not going to have automated medicine. We're not going to have expert system doctors. We're not going to have, we're not going to have various this or that. But other places in the world have it readily, and it'll make its way into this country, whether legally or illegally. And so, I think it would behoove us to change at that point. And
yeah, because one thing you certainly don't want is an unregulated, a completely pirate, as Ken says, bootleg nanobots. You do not want a completely renegade underground medical establishment working outside of the normal medical establishment. I mean, you know, it's one thing to take your chances and drink a little moonshine or spend an evening in a speakeasy. It's quite another to go to a speakeasy clinic to have a heart transplant. But I don't doubt that people will do it. Absolutely.
Computer virus would take on a whole new meaning, wouldn't it?
Absolutely,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
A very scary meaning, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that leaves us with 12 entire minutes to talk about, and I'm not scared. I think we can cover all these topics tonight with absolutely no problem. The third possibility, which is the nanobot medicine doesn't come along in time, so unfortunately... the operation is a big success, except they lose the patient. But that's okay. We've got good news for you there, too. And that good news is in the form of a new approach to cryonics that we wrote about a week ago. Actually, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Philip Van Netterveld talked about this a little bit when we had him on last year as part of the World Transformed.
Yeah, it was a little bit spooky, actually. I don't mean to be... negative about our guest. He was a good sport and came on in the middle of the night, if I remember correctly. But basically, you know, at that point, he was talking about actually people, you know, at the end of their lives for one reason or another, perhaps for because of disease or old age or whatever, basically putting themselves into storage before their death. And the point being that before the brain starts breaking down from the dying process, that you go ahead and put yourself in cryonics before. Now, obviously, that's a huge leap of faith, isn't it? Besides just allowing yourself to die and waste away in the grave, there's nothing more dangerous, I would think, than cryonics. And you're telling me we're going to do this before dying. And so basically, you're either committing suicide or you've got a bright future ahead of you. And it's just one or the other.
Yeah, I think under the law, certainly as it exists now, and Michael Nizimov wrote about this a little bit, it would definitely be considered suicide. And Michael's point, and I think the point of the fellow whose website I was linking, I cannot think of his name, it's Hayworth, something Hayworth, excuse me for not being able to get your name, and Philip, when he was on our show, they would all argue that that is not suicide, that's a rational that's a rational decision. And you can sort of see where if you've reached a point where quality of life is pretty much shot and you're just looking at, well, the best medical science can offer me is I can hang on here for another 18 months, another 2 years, whatever the window might be, but my brain's going to deteriorate significantly during that time. And by the time they do put it into the process, it's not going to be as... we're not going to be preserving as much as we would have to begin with. I can see where some people might want to make that leap. Probably a bigger topic than we have time for tonight. What was of interest to me was actually the technique for preserving the brain, which is not the old cold storage methodology, but actually this idea of replacing certain fluids within the brain with plastic resins and completely plastinating the brain. Storing the a complete perfect record, a complete perfect structure of the brain in plastic.
Have you seen the at least on TV or you know, on the movie Casino Royale, the James Bond movie Casino Royale? I believe they had they showed in that movie, and I've seen it elsewhere too. Those exhibits of the human body plasticized, you might have some guy that's skin removed, but he's on a horse.
Yes.
And
I've seen that.
I forget the name of that exhibit. But it's basically the same technology, isn't it? They're preserving the human body by removing fluids and inserting plastic. And by doing so, what you're attempting to do with the brain is to preserve the structure so that years from now, the structure of the brain, which shows, you know, basically what, at the molecular level, what your thoughts are, what your personality is, all is, your memories, all preserved so that when they can fix you, whatever problem you're suffering from, you make the trip. And that's the idea and the hope with that.
That's the real trick, for sure.
Yeah.
Now, two great comments from Sally. One is, I'm leery of freezing the brain because I think the operation of the brain is us, not just the static physical brain. I think that's an interesting position, and I'm not completely unsympathetic to that. The second point, I think plastinating would have the same problems as freezing. Actually, in terms of recoverability, from your standpoint, Sally, yes, it would have the same problems in that the brain has been completely shut down, and then we're going to try to restart it, and there's a question as to whether that restarted brain has actually got you in it the way the original brain did. However, plastination has tremendous advantages over freezing in that the infrastructure required for it is much less, and the expense involved is going to be much less. You can store a plastinated brain, to be perfectly frank about it, at room temperature.
You
a piece of plastic.
You could have your dead relative's brain up on the mantle in your house. You don't have to put it in cold storage anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's not what people would do. It will be kept more carefully than that, but.
Exactly.
I mean, you think about the difference. You're talking about a frozen brain, human brain tissue, this incredibly volatile structure, and just the volatility of that whole freezing and storage process compared to plastic, which, you know, environmentally we've got this huge problem that plastic doesn't go anywhere. You can't break it down. It lasts forever. You know, this is the big problem with plastic. Well, the big problem with plastic becomes a big advantage if you're trying to store tissue. So, for Sally's first objection, I don't have an answer to that. We got into these heavy philosophical waters in the discussions to my original blog post. I was perfectly clear with everyone about what really validly is a legitimate transfer of my consciousness and what isn't. And I set the boundaries out. If people would just read my explanation, I think there'd be no more misunderstandings or dispute. Yeah, there would need to be no more discussion on this topic. But I don't know. Nobody seems to get me. No, I think it's one we're going to be arguing about for a long time. There's extreme positions. Sally's, I think, is rather extreme. Sally is saying if the brain stops and then restarts, you're not there anymore. You've got the other folks who say if you destroy the brain but you've got a copy and that starts up, you're still there. And yeah. I'm somewhere in the middle. I think you are too, Stephen, where I'm like, well, maybe if you stop my brain and restart it, I'm still there. But if you destroy my brain and make a copy, I'm not at all sure that I'm there.
Yeah. Now, the only way I would go along with the copying process is if it's slow and gradual. And,
right.
You know, let's say I've got a computer hooked to my brain that slowly copies me, but I'm, as that process is going on, I'm continuing my life, let's say. And at that point, I will have made the trip. The carbonite backup Steve might be the right guy. So
yeah.
Anyway,
certainly, whoever wakes up thinks he's you and has all your memories, and for his subjective experience will be one of a continuation of you. But you want that to be a continuation of the subjective experience that's going on right now. You see, that's the rather than the start of a new one that thinks it's a continuation of the old one.
We have had this conversation in relation to transporters too.
It's the exact same conversation.
Same conversation. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh well.
And same resolution, which is to say, looks like we're out of time. What's our music?
Okay. Oh shoot. Tonight is "Remember" by Black Lab.
Perfect. Perfect. Black Lab, one of our favorite bands. I've loved the double entendre name. I'm sure it's in reference to a dog, and yet to me, it could also be a underground lab where they're doing secret nanobot research. So remember, we hope that if a plastic version of our brain shows up, it not only remembers, but still has us inside. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Look forward to listening to that song. Thanks to everyone who participated. Great chat this evening, all of you who listened live and everyone listening to us via recording. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We will be back again next week, and until then, live to see it.